Latin, not a word of which they understood, he told Abigail. The dress of the priest was rich with lace. His pulpit was velvet and gold. The altarpiece was very rich, little images and crucifixes about, wax candles lighted up. But how shall I describe the picture of our Savior? In a frame of marble over the altar at full length upon the cross, in the agonies, and the blood dropping and streaming from his wounds. Yet Adam stayed through all of the long service. The music and chanting of the assembly continued through the afternoon, most sweetly and exquisitely. And he quite approved of the priest's good, short, moral essay on the duty of parents to see to their children's temporal and spiritual interests. The whole experience, Adams concluded, was awful and affecting, the word awful then meaning full of awe, or that which strikes with awe or fills with reverence. For one accustomed also to the plainest of domestic comforts and daily fare, and who loved to eat, the scale of Philadelphia hospitality in the opening weeks of the First Congress had been memorable. Not even in New York had he seen such display of private wealth, or dined and imbibed so grandly. At a great dinner for Congress in the banqueting hall at the State House on September 16, 1774, a total of 31 toasts had been raised before the affair ended. There were further elegant receptions and dinners in the homes of the Mifflins, the Shippens, the Powells, Cadwalladers, and Dickinsons, extended gatherings presided over and attended by many of the most beautiful, fashionably dressed women of Philadelphia. "I shall be killed with kindness in this place," he told Abigail. "We go to Congress at 9, and there we stay, most earnestly engaged until 3 in the afternoon. Then we adjourn and go to dinner with some of the nobles of Pennsylvania at 4 o'clock and feast on 10,000 delicacies and sit drinking Madeira, claret, and Burgundy till 6 or 7. Even plain Quakers, he reported, served ducks, hams, chickens, beef, creams, and custards. "A most sinful feast again," he recorded after another occasion, this in the splendor of a great four-story mansion on 3rd Street, the home of Mayor Samuel Powell, whose wealth and taste could be measured in richly carved paneling, magnificent paintings, a tea service in solid silver that would have fetched considerably more than the entire contents of the Adams household at Braintree. "Dined with Mr. Benjamin Chu, Chief Justice of the province," he began still another diary entry. "Turtle and every other thing, flummery, jellies, sweetmeats of 20 sorts, trifles, whipped syllabubs, floating islands, and then a dessert of fruits, raisins, almonds, pears, peaches, wines most excellent and admirable. I drank Madeira at a great rate and found no inconvenience in it." Within the walls of Congress, he was at first dazzled by the other delegates, who, he decided, comprised an assembly surpassing any in history. Of the 54 in attendance, nearly half were lawyers, and most had received a college education. Several, like Washington, were known to be men of great wealth, but others, like Roger Sherman of Connecticut, had humbler origins. He had begun as a shoemaker. As observant of people as ever, Adams recorded his impressions in vivid fragmentary notes of a kind kept by no other member of Congress. Richard Henry Lee of Virginia was a tall, spare, masterly man. Roger Sherman spoke often and long, but very heavily. James Duane of New York had a sly, surveying eye, but appeared very sensible. Joseph Galloway, a leading Philadelphia attorney and speaker of the Pennsylvania Assembly, who would later resign from Congress and ultimately seek refuge with the British Army, struck Adams at first meeting as having an air of design and cunning. John Dickinson, another prominent Philadelphian, was a shadow, pale as ashes. Adams doubted he would live a month. Caesar Rodney of Delaware was the oddest-looking man in the world. Slender as a reed, pale. His face is not bigger than a large apple. Yet there is sense and fire, spirit, wit, and humor in his countenance. Adams was amazed by the range and variety of talents. The art and address of ambassadors from a dozen belligerent powers of Europe, nay, of a conclave of cardinals at the election of a pope, would not exceed the specimens we have seen. Here were fortunes, abilities, learning, eloquence, acuteness, equal to any. Every question is discussed with moderation, and an acuteness and minuteness equal to that of Queen Elizabeth's Privy Council. But after a month of such acuteness and minuteness over every issue at hand, irrespective of importance, Adams was wearied to death. The business of Congress had become tedious beyond expression, he told Abigail. This assembly is like no other that ever existed. Every man in it is a great man, an orator, a critic, a statesman, and therefore every man upon every question must show his oratory, his criticism, and his political abilities. The consequence of this is that business is drawn and spun out to immeasurable length. I believe if it was moved and seconded that we should come to a resolution that 3 and 2 make 5, we should be entertained with logic and rhetoric, law, history, politics, and mathematics concerning the subject for 2 whole days, and then we should pass the resolution unanimously in the affirmative. Certain members began to irritate him. The perpetual round of feasting became only another burden of his pilgrimage. Even Philadelphia lost its charm. For all its wealth and regularity, Adams decided, Philadelphia was no Boston. Yet on departure from the First Congress in late October of 1774, after a stay of 2 months, he had written wistfully of the happy, peaceful, the elegant, the hospitable, and polite city of Philadelphia, wondering if he would ever be back. By the time he returned for the Second Continental Congress, in late spring 1775, a month after Lexington and Concord, Philadelphia had become the capital of a revolution. Troops were drilling. Lavish entertaining was out of fashion. Congress was in the throes of creating an army, appointing a commander-in-chief, issuing the first Continental money. With several other delegates, Adams spent a day inspecting defenses on the Delaware. There are in this city 3 large regiments raised, formed, armed, trained, and uniformed under officers consisting of gentlemen of the very first fortune and best character in the place, Adams reported to Abigail's uncle, Isaac Smith, a prosperous Boston merchant whom Adams greatly admired. All this started up since the 19th of April, since Lexington and Concord. They cover the common every day of the week, Sundays not excepted. The deliberations of Congress, meantime, had been moved from Carpenter's Hall to the larger, grander State House on the south side of Chestnut Street, between 5th and 6th Streets. Built some 40 years before, it comprised a handsome main edifice, 2 stories tall with a bell tower, and arcaded wings joining smaller offices at either end, all of it done in red brick. High on the exterior west wall of the main building, a large clock proclaimed the hour. Congress convened in the assembly room on the first floor, to the left of the Chestnut Street entrance. An ample chamber, measuring 40 by 40 feet, it was notably devoid of decoration. Neat, but not elegant, with whitewashed walls and flooded with daylight from high windows on both the north and south sides. On a low platform at the east end of the room stood a single, tall-backed chair for the president. There were two wood stoves and on the east wall twin fireplaces, one on either side of the president's chair. Seats for the delegates, 50 or so Windsor chairs, were arranged in a semicircle facing the president's chair. These, interspersed with work tables, covered with green baize cloths and clustered according to region. New England on the left, middle colonies in the center, southern colonies on the right. The Pennsylvania Assembly, having given up its space, had moved across the hall to the more elaborate Supreme Court room, where the royal coat of arms hung. At the rear of the hall, a broad stairway led to the banqueting room that extended 100 feet, the full length of the building. Outside, to the rear, was the State House yard, an open public green the size of a city block, and enclosed the whole way around by a 7-foot brick wall. The Rittenhouse observation platform stood off to one side, and at the center of the far wall, a huge, single-arched wooden gate, twice the height of the wall, opened onto Walnut Street. In good weather, as a place for the delegates to stretch their legs and talk privately, the yard was ideal. Many days more business was transacted there than inside. And with the yard serving also now as a place to store cannon and barrels of gunpowder, the war was never far from consciousness. All sessions of Congress were conducted in strictest secrecy behind closed doors, because of the number of British agents in and about Philadelphia, and the need to convey an impression of unity, that all members were perfectly agreed on the results of their deliberations. Consequently, like others, Adams could report comparatively little in his letters home, except that the hours were longer than ever, the issues of greater urgency, the strain worse on everybody. His health suffered. His eyes bothered him, to the point that he had difficulty reading. He wrote of the frustrations of wasting, exhausting debates. America was a great unwieldy body, he decided. Its progress must be slow. It is like a large fleet sailing under convoy. The fleetest sailors must wait for the dullest and slowest. Yet he would not give up or let down. I will not despond. A sweltering, fly-infested summer of 1775 was followed by an autumn of almost unceasing rains. Dysentery broke out in the military camps. Adams, though suffering from rheumatism and a violent cold, worked 12 to 14 hours a day. In committee meetings from 7 to 10 in the morning, then to the full Congress till late afternoon, then back to committees from 6 to 10 at night. Politics were no less perplexing than ever. Politics are a labyrinth without a clue, he wrote. But he had come to understand the makeup of Congress. He knew the delegates now as he had not before, and they had come to know him. That he was repeatedly chosen for the most important committees was a measure of his influence and of the respect others had for his integrity, his intellect, and exceptional capacity for hard work. He was the leading committee man of the Massachusetts delegation, perhaps indeed of the whole Congress. By October, at the time of Abigail's shattering ordeal with sickness and death at home, Adams was writing to say they must prepare themselves, minds and hearts, for every event, even the worst. Since his first involvement in the cause of America, he had known the crisis would never be settled peaceably, and this, he told her in confidence, had been a source of much disquietude. The thought that we might be driven to the sad necessity of breaking our connection with Great Britain, exclusive of the carnage and destruction which it was easy to see must attend the separation, always gave me a great deal of grief. Section 2. Possibly it was his first or second day back in Philadelphia in early February 1776, after the long wintry journey from home, that Adams, in his room at Mrs. Yard's, drew up a list of what he was determined to see accomplished. Or, as appears more likely from its placement in his diary, the list had been composed earlier, somewhere en route. Undated, it included an alliance to be formed with France and Spain, government to be assumed by every colony, powder mills to be built in every colony, and fresh efforts to make saltpeter for the making of gunpowder. And on the second of the two small opposing pages in the diary, he wrote a Declaration of Independency. Independence had been talked about privately and alluded to in correspondence, but rarely spoken of directly in public declamation or in print. To Adams, independence was the only guarantee of American liberty, and he was determined that the great step be taken. The only question was when to make the move. If a decision were forced on Congress too soon, the result could be disastrous. Independence would be voted down. But every day that independence was put off would mean added difficulties in the course of the larger struggle. Abigail, in one of her letters, aptly offered some favorite lines from Shakespeare. There is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in the shallows and in miseries. And we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. But just when to catch the tide was the question. By Adams's estimate, Congress was about equally divided three ways. Those opposed to independence, who were Tories at heart if not openly, those too cautious or timid to take a position one way or the other, and the true blue, as he said, who wanted to declare independence with all possible speed. So, as yet, the voices for independence were decidedly in the minority. Indeed, the delegates of six colonies, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and South Carolina, were under specific instructions not to vote for independence. The opposing argument hung on the lingering possibility of a last-minute reconciliation with Britain. Were not the likes of Edmund Burke speaking out in Parliament for American rights, it was said? Supposedly a peace commission was on the way from London. To Adams, such talk was a phantom. The ministry, he wrote, have caught the colonies as I have often caught a horse, by holding an empty hat as if it was full of corn. But throughout the middle colonies, as in parts of the South, great numbers of people had no wish to separate from the mother country. In Philadelphia, such sentiment ran strong, and not just among the city's numerous Tories. The plot thickens, thinking people uneasy, observed a local attorney. The Congress in equilibrio on the question of independence or no. I love the cause of liberty, but cannot heartily join in the presentation of measures totally foreign to the original plan of resistance. To many staunchly pacifist Quakers, any step that led nearer to all-out war was anathema. To them, George III was the best of kings, and they spoke of those who called themselves patriots as the violent people. The mood of the city had become extremely contentious. The malignant air of calumny has taken possession of almost all ranks and societies of people in this place, wrote Christopher Marshall, an apothecary and committed patriot, though a Quaker, who had become one of Adams's circle of Philadelphia friends. The rich, the poor, the high professor, and the profane seem all to be infected with this grievous disorder. so that the love of our neighbor seems to be quite banished. The love of self and opinions so far prevails. The Tory enemies of our present struggle are grown even scurrilous to individuals, and treat all characters who differ from them with the most opprobrious language. In Congress, the strain was showing. From Virginia had come word that the royal governor, Lord Dunmore, having escaped to the safety of a British man of war, had called on all slaves to rebel, promising them their freedom if they joined the king's forces. On New Year's Day, he had ordered the bombardment of Norfolk. Southern delegates were outraged. At the same time, the bad news from Canada had had much the same effect witnessed by Adams in the wayside taverns en route from Massachusetts. "There is a deep anxiety, a kind of thoughtful melancholy," he reported to Abigail. Writing again, he stressed that the events of war were always uncertain. Then, paraphrasing a favorite line from the popular play Cato by Joseph Addison, a line that General Washington, too, would often call upon, Adams told her, "We cannot ensure success, but we can deserve it." With sickness widespread in Philadelphia, there was much hacking and coughing in Congress and many a long, sallow look. When some of the delegates protested that smoke from the wood stoves in the chamber was the cause of such poor health, the stoves were removed. Other ailments struck. Thomas Lynch of South Carolina suffered a stroke from which he would not recover. Smallpox reappeared in the city, putting everyone further on edge. In March, one of New England's most prominent delegates, Samuel Ward of Rhode Island, would die of the disease. On February 27th, word arrived that Parliament, in December, had prohibited all trade with the colonies and denounced as traitors all Americans who did not make an unconditional submission. The punishment for treason, as every member of Congress knew, was death by hanging. A vast British armada was reported underway across the Atlantic, and there were ominous rumors of the king hiring an army of German mercenaries. It was the New Englanders who held firm for independence, though two of the Massachusetts delegation, John Hancock and Robert Treat Paine, exhibited nothing like the zeal of either Samuel Adams or Elbridge Gerry. There were many, too, among the other delegations who could be counted on, though unfortunately several of the most important were absent. Richard Henry Lee of Virginia would not appear at Philadelphia until the middle of March. Caesar Rodney of Delaware would be away until April. Thomas Jefferson of Virginia would not arrive for another 3 months, not until the middle of May. Meanwhile, time was wasting, and a great deal needed doing. Present nearly every day, notwithstanding his years and infirmities, was Benjamin Franklin, who at age 70 was popularly perceived to be the oldest, wisest head in the Congress, which he was, and the most influential, which he was not. Franklin wanted independence, and considered Congress lamentably irresolute on the matter, as he told Adams. Franklin had no expectation of new terms from Britain, and from long experience in London as an agent for Pennsylvania, he knew the king and the foreign ministry as did no one else in Congress. But Franklin had no liking for floor debate. He was patient, imperturbable, and at times sound asleep in his chair. Never would he argue a point. Indeed, it was rare that he spoke at all or ventured an opinion except in private conversation, which to Adams, who was almost incapable of staying out of an argument, was extremely difficult to comprehend. "He has not assumed anything," Adams wrote in frustration, "nor affected to take the lead, but has seemed to choose that the Congress pursue their own sentiments and adopt their own plans." that Franklin was quietly proposing to equip the Continental Army with bows and arrows must have left Adams still more puzzled. For Adams, any sustained equivalent of Franklin's benign calm would have been impossible. Knowing his hour had come, and that he must rise to the occasion and play a leading part, he would play it with all that was in him. Among the opposition, there were only two whom he disliked, Benjamin Harrison and Edward Rutledge. Harrison, an outspoken Virginia planter, 6 feet 4 inches tall and immensely fat, was a fervent champion of American rights who liked to say he would have come to Philadelphia on foot had it been necessary. To Adams, nonetheless, he was a profane and impious fool. Rutledge, the youngest member, was dandified, 26 years old, and overflowing with self-confidence. At first, Adams judged him smart if not deep, but the more Rutledge talked, the more he expressed disagreement with Adams, the more scathing Adams's assessment became, to the point where in his diary he appeared nearly to run out of words. "Young Ned Rutledge is a perfect bobolincoln, a swallow, a sparrow, a peacock, excessively vain, excessively weak, and excessively variable and unsteady, jejune, inane, and puerile." Yet Adams remained pointedly courteous to both men, as to others of the anti-independence faction. Among the surprises of the unfolding drama, as tensions increased, was the extent to which the ardent, disputatious John Adams held himself in rein, proving, when need be, a model of civility and self-restraint, even of patience. In later years, Adams would recall the warning advice given the Massachusetts delegation the day of their arrival for the first Congress. Benjamin Rush, Thomas Mifflin, and two or three other Philadelphia patriots had ridden out to welcome the Massachusetts men, and at a tavern in the village of Frankfort, in the seclusion of a private room, they told the New Englanders they were suspected of having independence in view. They were perceived to be too zealous and must not presume to take the lead. Virginia, they were reminded, was the largest, richest, and most populous of the colonies, and the very proud Virginians felt they had the right to lead. According to Adams, the advice made a deep impression, and among the consequences was the choice of George Washington to head the army. But Adams also wrote that he had not in my nature prudence and caution enough always to stand back. Years before, at age 20, he had set down in his diary that men ought to avow their opinions and defend them with boldness, and he was of the same metal still. The bulwark of the opposition, of the cool faction, was the Pennsylvania delegation, and the greatly respected John Dickinson was its eloquent floor leader. Cautious, conservative by nature, Dickinson was, as Adams had noted, a distinctive figure, tall and exceptionally slender, with almost no color in his face. Because of his Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer, an early pamphlet on the evils of British policy, Dickinson had become a hero. He was the farmer, his name spoken everywhere, though he was hardly the plain man of the soil many imagined. Born to wealth and raised on an estate in Delaware, he had trained in the law at London and made his career in Philadelphia, where he had risen rapidly to the top of his profession. Married to a Quaker heiress, he lived in grand style, riding through the city in a magnificent coach and four, attended by liveried black slaves. His townhouse, catter-cornered to the State House on Chestnut Street, was then undergoing extensive alterations, and thought to be too large and showy even by his wife, who preferred their nearby country seat, Fairhill. Dickinson had wished to make a good first impression on Adams, and he succeeded. As a dinner guest at Fairhill during the First Congress, Adams was charmed. "Dickinson has an excellent heart, and the cause of his country lies near it," Adams had written. As for his initial concern that the rigors of Congress might be too much for someone of such delicate appearance, Adams had learned better. Though afflicted with the gout, Dickinson had since assumed command of a Philadelphia battalion with the rank of colonel. He had become the politician soldier of the sort Adams so often imagined himself. Yet it was with a determination no less than Adams's own that Dickinson kept telling Congress that peaceful methods for resolving the current crisis were still possible and greatly preferable. He was not a Tory. He was not opposed to independence in principle. Rather, he insisted, now was not the time for so dangerous and irrevocable a decision. Adams had come to believe that Dickinson's real struggle was with his mother and his wife, both devout Quakers who bedeviled him with their pacifist views. "If I had such a mother and such a wife," Adams would reflect years later, recalling Dickinson's predicament, "I believe I should have shot myself." Outraged by Dickinson's insistence on petitions to the king as essential to restoring peace, even after Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill, Adams had strongly denounced any such step. Like many other delegates, he had been infuriated by Congress's humble petition of July 8, 1775, the so-called Olive Branch Petition, that had been Dickinson's major contribution. From the day he saw with his own eyes what the British had done at Lexington and Concord, Adams failed to understand how anyone could have any misconception or naive hope about what to expect from the British. "Powder and artillery are the most efficacious, sure, and infallible conciliatory measures we can adopt," Adams wrote privately. In a speech on the floor of Congress, Dickinson warned the New England delegates that they would have blood on their heads if they excluded the possibility of peace. Adams, springing to his feet, responded so vehemently that when he left the chamber, Dickinson came rushing after to confront him outside. "What is the reason, Mr. Adams, that you New England men oppose our measures of reconciliation?" Dickinson angrily demanded, according to Adams's later account of the scene. "Look ye, if you don't concur with us in our pacific system, I and a number of us will break off from you in New England, and we will carry on the opposition by ourselves in our own way." Though infuriated by Dickinson's magisterial tone, Adams replied calmly that there were many accommodations he would make in the cause of harmony and unanimity. He would not, however, be threatened. Venting his fire in a private letter, Adams portrayed Dickinson as a piddling genius who lent a silly cast to deliberations. The letter was intercepted by British agents and widely published in Tory newspapers, with the result that Dickinson refused to speak when one morning on their way to the State House he and Adams passed near enough to touch elbows, as Adams recorded that day. "He passed without moving his hat or head or hand. I bowed and pulled off my hat. He passed haughtily by. But I was determined to make my bow, that I might know his temper. We are not to be on speaking terms nor bowing terms for the time to come." Others refused to speak to Adams, so great was the respect for Dickinson in Congress and in the city. A British spy in Philadelphia named Gilbert Barclay reported to his contact in London, "The Quakers and many others look on him," Adams, "and others of his way of thinking, as the greatest enemies of this country." For weeks, Adams was ostracized. "Avoided like a man infected with leprosy," he would remember. He felt as he had after the Boston Massacre trials, borne down by the weight of unpopularity. Benjamin Rush would write sympathetically of Adams walking the streets of Philadelphia alone, an object of nearly universal scorn and detestation. Such was the support for Dickinson and the Olive Branch Petition that Adams and his colleagues were left no choice but to acquiesce. The petition was agreed to, only to be summarily dismissed by George III, who refused even to look at it and proclaimed the colonies in a state of rebellion. Still, Dickinson and the anti-independents clung to the hope of a resolution to the crisis, insisting reconciliation was still possible, and so the wait for the peace commissioners had continued. What neither John Dickinson nor John Adams nor anyone could have anticipated was the stunning effect of common sense. The little pamphlet had become a clarion call, rousing spirits within Congress and without as nothing else had. The first edition, attributed to an unnamed Englishman, and published by Robert Bell in a print shop on 3rd Street, appeared January 9, 1776. By the time Adams had resumed his place in Congress a month later, Common Sense had gone into a third edition and was sweeping the colonies. In little time, more than 100,000 copies were in circulation. "Who is the author of Common Sense?" asked a correspondent from South Carolina in the Philadelphia Evening Post. "He deserves a statue of gold." Written to be understood by everyone, Common Sense attacked the very idea of hereditary monarchy as absurd and evil, and named the royal brute, George III, as the cause of every woe in America. It was a call to arms, an unabashed argument for war, and a call for American independence, something that had never been said so boldly before in print. Why is it that we hesitate? The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth. For God's sake, let us come to a final separation. The birthday of a new world is at hand. The British spy, Barclay, reported its publication, as he did such other vital news items as the arrival of shipments of gunpowder from the West Indies, or the sailing from Philadelphia of armed sloops and brigantines flying what they call the American flag. The anonymous author was revealed to be a down-at-the-heels English immigrant, Thomas Paine, who had landed at Philadelphia a year earlier with little more than a letter of introduction from Benjamin Franklin. Paine had been encouraged in his efforts by Benjamin Rush, who was himself the author of a pamphlet on the evils of slavery, and it was Rush who provided the title. Friends in Massachusetts reported to Adams that because of common sense, the clamor for a declaration of independence was never greater. "This is the time. We have never had such a favorable moment," wrote one. In a letter to Abigail, referring to the copy he had sent her, Adams said he expected common sense to become the common faith, and on learning that in Boston he, Adams, was presumed to be the author, he felt flattered. Writing to a former law clerk, he declared himself innocent, saying he could never have achieved a style of such strength and brevity. But Adams was not without misgivings. The more he thought about it, the less he admired common sense. The writer, he told Abigail, has a better hand at pulling down than building. That Paine had attempted to prove the unlawfulness of monarchy with analogies from the Bible, declaring monarchy to be one of the sins of the Jews, struck Adams as ridiculous. Paine had assured his readers that in a war with Britain, Americans, being such experienced seamen and willing soldiers, and having such an abundance of war materiel at hand, would readily triumph. Adams had no illusions about the prospect of war with Britain. Almost alone among the members of Congress, he saw no quick victory, but a long, painful struggle. The war, he warned prophetically in a speech on February 22nd, could last 10 years. What was more, as he confided to Abigail's uncle, Isaac Smith, he thought, "This American contest will light up a general war in Europe." But it was Paine's feeble understanding of constitutional government, his outline of a unicameral legislature to be established once independence was achieved, that disturbed Adams most. In response, he began setting down his own thoughts on government, resolved, as he later wrote, to do all in my power to counteract the effect on the popular mind of so foolish a plan. Meanwhile, for all the gloom and discord at the State House, Congress was making decisions. On February 26th, there was enacted an embargo on exports to Britain. On March 2nd, Silas Deane was appointed a secret envoy to France to go, in the character of a merchant, to buy clothing and arms, and to appraise the disposition of France should the colonies declare independence. Oliver Wolcott, Deane's fellow delegate from Connecticut, sensed the approach of a moment that could decide the fate of this country. Adams busily jotted notes. Is any assistance attainable from France? What connection may we safely form with her? First, no political connection. Submit to none of her authority. Second, no military connection. Receive no troops from her. Third, only a commercial connection. In the hope that the Canadians could be persuaded to join the American cause as the 14th colony, Congress organized a diplomatic expedition to Montreal with Benjamin Franklin at its head, and despite his age and poor health, Franklin departed on what was to be an exceedingly arduous and futile mission. Adams joined in floor debate day after day, arguing a point, pleading, persuading, and nearly always with effect. No one spoke more often or with greater force. Every important step was opposed and carried by bare majorities, which obliged me to be almost constantly engaged in debate, he would recall. But I was not content with all that was done, and almost every day I had something to say about advising the states to institute governments, to express my total despair of any good coming from the petition or of those things which were called conciliatory measures. I constantly insisted that all such measures, instead of having any tendency to produce a reconciliation, would only be considered as proofs of our timidity and want of confidence in the ground we stood on, and would only encourage our enemies to greater exertions against us. Rarely did he prepare his remarks in advance other than in his mind, so that once on his feet he could speak from what he knew and what he strongly felt. He had tried writing his speeches, but found it impossible. "I understand it not," he would tell Benjamin Rush. "I never could write declamations, orations, or popular addresses." He had no liking for grand oratorical flourishes. "Affectation is as disagreeable in a letter as in conversation," he once told Abigail, in explanation of his views on epistolary style. And the same principle applied to making a speech. The art of persuasion, he held, depended mainly on a marshaling of facts, clarity, conviction, and the ability to think on one's feet. True eloquence consisted of truth and rapid reason. As a British spy was later to write astutely of Adams, he also had a particular gift for seeing large subjects largely. He would stand at his place, back straight, walking stick in hand, at times letting the stick slip between thumb and forefinger to make a quick tap on the floor as if to punctuate a point. The clear and sonorous voice would fill the room. No one ever had trouble hearing what Adams had to say. Nor was there ever the least ambiguity about what he meant. Nothing of what he or anyone said in the course of debate was officially recorded. But in later writings, Adams recalled stressing certain points repeatedly. "We shall be driven to the necessity of declaring ourselves independent, and we ought now to be employed in preparing a plan for confederation of the colonies," here might come the sharp tap of the stick, "and treaties to be proposed to foreign power," tap, "together with a declaration of independence," tap. "Foreign powers cannot be expected to acknowledge us till we have acknowledged ourselves and taken our station among them as a sovereign power," tap, "an independent nation," tap. On March 14th, Congress voted to disarm all Tories. On March 23rd, in a momentous step, the delegates resolved to permit the outfitting of privateers, armed vessels, to prey on the enemies of the United Colonies, a move Adams roundly supported. In the advocacy of sea defenses, he stood second to none. The previous fall, he had urged the creation of an American fleet, which to some, like Samuel Chase of Maryland, had seemed the maddest idea in the world. The fight began on the floor, and on October 13th, to the extent of authorizing funds for two small swift-sailing ships, Congress founded a navy. By the end of the year, Congress had directed that 13 frigates be built. Adams was appointed to a naval committee that met in a rented room at Tun Tavern, and it was Adams who drafted the first set of rules and regulations for the new navy, a point of pride with him for as long as he lived. Knowing nothing of armed ships, he made himself expert, and would call his work on the Naval Committee the pleasantest part of his labors, in part because it brought him in contact with one of the singular figures in Congress, Stephen Hopkins of Rhode Island, who was nearly as old as Franklin and always wore his broad-brimmed Quaker hat in the chamber. Adams found most Quakers to be dull as beetles, but Hopkins was an exception. A lively, learned man, he had seen a great deal of life, suffered the loss of three sons at sea, and served in one public office or other continuously from the time he was 25. The old gentleman loved to drink rum and expound on his favorite writers. The experience and judgment he brought to the business of Congress were of great use, as Adams wrote, but it was in after hours that he kept us alive. His custom was to drink nothing all day, nor till 8 o'clock in the evening, and then his beverage was Jamaica spirits and water. He read Greek, Roman, and British history, and was familiar with English poetry. And the flow of his soul made his reading our own, and seemed to bring to recollection in all of us all we had ever read. Hopkins never drank to excess, according to Adams, but all he drank was promptly converted into wit, sense, knowledge, and good humor. There was more to be done by sea and land than anyone knew, Adams kept saying. When, on March 25th, word arrived that the British had abandoned Boston, setting off jubilant celebration in Philadelphia, he lost no time in advocating the immediate fortification of Boston Harbor. "Fortify, fortify, and never let them in again," he urged a friend at home. On April 6th, in another decisive step, Congress opened American ports to the trade of all nations except Britain. Half measures would not answer, Adams knew. The tentative attitude of Dickinson and the Quaker interests was becoming more and more difficult to tolerate. Adams's sense of urgency grew greater by the day. "The middle way is no way at all," he wrote to General Horatio Gates. "If we finally fail in this great and glorious contest, it will be by bewildering ourselves in groping for the middle way. This story of peace, commissioners, is as errant an illusion as ever hatched in the brain of an enthusiast, a politician, or a maniac, he told Abigail in a letter in which he confided that he had been busy about something, about 10 sheets of paper with my own hand, that he would have to tell her about later. Adams's Thoughts on Government, as it would be known, was first set forth in a letter to a fellow congressman, William Hooper, who, before returning home to help write a new constitution for North Carolina, had asked Adams for a sketch of his views. When another of the North Carolinians, John Penn, requested a copy, this, too, Adams provided, in addition to 3 more copies, all written out by hand, for Jonathan Sargent of New Jersey and Virginians George Wythe and Richard Henry Lee, who, with Adams's consent, had the letter published as a pamphlet by the Philadelphia printer John Dunlap. For Adams, the structure of government was a subject of passionate interest that raised fundamental questions about the realities of human nature, political power, and the good society. It was a concern that for years had propelled much of his reading and the exchange of ideas with those whose judgment he most respected, including Abigail, who had written to him the year before, "I am more and more convinced that man is a dangerous creature, and that power, whether vested in many or few, is ever grasping." "The great fish swallow up the small," she had continued. "And he who is most strenuous for the rights of the people, when vested with power, is as eager after the prerogatives of government. You tell me of degrees of perfection to which human nature is capable of arriving, and I believe it, but at the same time lament that our admiration should arise from the scarcity of the instances." Adams had accused Thomas Paine of being better at tearing down than building. In what he wrote in response, he was being the builder, as best he knew. "To do this, he had had to borrow a little time from my sleep. He was exhausted," he acknowledged, "but he seems also to have sensed the importance of what he had done." "It has been the will of heaven," the essay began, "that we should be thrown into existence at a period when the greatest philosophers and lawgivers of antiquity would have wished to live. A period when a coincidence of circumstances without example has afforded to 13 colonies at once an opportunity of beginning government anew from the foundation and building as they choose. How few of the human race have ever had an opportunity of choosing a system of government for themselves and their children? How few have ever had anything more of choice in government than in climate?" He was looking beyond independence, beyond the outcome of the war, to what would be established once independence and victory were achieved. Much as he foresaw the hard truth about the war to be waged, Adams had the clearest idea of anyone in Congress of what independence would actually entail, the great difficulties and risks, no less than the opportunities. When arguing cases in court, he liked to draw on the fables of La Fontaine, and to quote the line, "In everything one must consider the end." "The happiness of the people was the purpose of government," he wrote, "and therefore that form of government was best which produced the greatest amount of happiness for the largest number. And since all sober inquirers after truth agreed that happiness derived from virtue, that form of government with virtue as its foundation was more likely than any other to promote the general happiness. The greatest minds agreed," Adams continued, "that all good government was republican, and the true idea of a republic was an empire of laws and not of men. a phrase not original with Adams, but that he had borrowed from the writings of the 17th-century philosopher James Harrington. A government with a single legislative body would never do. There should be a representative assembly, an exact portrait in miniature of the people at large, but it must not have the whole legislative power, for the reason that, like an individual with unchecked power, it could be subject to fits of humor, transports of passion, partialities of prejudice. A single assembly could grow avaricious, exempt itself from burdens, become ambitious, and after some time vote itself perpetual. Balance would come from the creation of a second, smaller legislative body, a distinct assembly of perhaps 20 or 30, chosen by the larger legislature. This council, as Adams called it, would be given free and independent judgment upon all acts of legislation, that it may be able to check and correct the errors of the others. The executive, the governor, should, Adams thought, be chosen by the two houses of the legislature, and for not more than a year at a time. Executive power would include the veto and the appointment of all judges and justices, as well as militia officers, thus making the executive the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Essential to the stability of government, and to an able and impartial administration of justice, Adams stressed, was separation of judicial power from both the legislative and executive. There must be an independent judiciary. Men of experience on the laws, of exemplary morals, invincible patience, unruffled calmness, and indefatigable application should be subservient to none and appointed for life. Finally and emphatically, he urged the widest possible support for education. Laws for the liberal education of youth, especially for the lower classes of people, are so extremely wise and useful that to a humane and generous mind, no expense for this purpose would be thought extravagant. Little that Adams ever wrote had such effect as his thoughts on government. Yet he felt it was too rough, crude in execution. He regretted insufficient time to write more correctly. From Abigail came long letters filled with news from home, of family, of politics, of her day-to-day struggle to manage expenses, cope with shortages, and keep the farm going, a responsibility for which little in her background had prepared her. Frugality, industry, and economy are the lessons of the day, she confided to a friend. At least they must be so for me, or my small boat will suffer shipwreck. To John, she pleaded repeatedly for more news of his health and his outlook, and filled pages with her own feelings for all that was transpiring at Philadelphia. She was particularly curious about the Virginians, wondering if, as slaveholders, they had the necessary commitment to the cause of freedom. "I have," she wrote, "sometimes been ready to think that the passion for liberty cannot be equally strong in the breasts of those who have been accustomed to deprive their fellow creature of theirs." What she felt about those in Massachusetts who owned slaves, including her own father, she did not say. But she need not have. John knew her mind on the subject. Writing to him during the first Congress, she had been unmistakably clear. "I wish most sincerely there was not a slave in the province. It always seemed a most iniquitous scheme to me, to fight ourselves for what we are daily robbing and plundering from those who have as good a right to freedom as we have." It had been 2 weeks now since she had seen the British fleet sail out of Boston, and she viewed the approach of spring very differently than she had only a month before. Her world had been transformed. She was experiencing an uncommon gaiety de cœur, she wrote. I think the sun shines brighter, the birds sing more melodiously. She longed to hear word of independence declared. Her spirit took flight at the thought. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies, and be more favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands. Borrowing a line from a poem by Daniel Defoe that she knew he would recognize, for he had used it too, she wrote, "Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could." If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. That your sex are naturally tyrannical is a truth so thoroughly established as to admit of no dispute, but such of yours as wish to be happy willingly give up the harsh title of master for the more tender and endearing one of friend. Why, then, not put it out of the power of the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity with impunity? Men of sense in all ages abhor those customs which treat us only as vassals of your sex. Regard us, then, as being placed by Providence under your protection, and, in imitation of the Supreme Being, make use of that power only for our happiness. She was not being entirely serious. In part, in her moment of springtime gaiety, she was teasing him. But only in part. Adams responded in a light spirit. "I cannot but laugh," he began. "We have been told that our struggle has loosened the bands of government everywhere, that children and apprentices were disobedient, that schools and colleges were grown turbulent, that Indians slighted their guardians and Negroes grew insolent to their masters. But your letter was the first intimation that another tribe, more numerous and powerful than all the rest, were grown discontented. This is rather too coarse a compliment, but you are so saucy I won't blot it out. Depend on it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. Although they are in full force, you know they are little more than theory. We dare not exert our power in its full latitude. We are obliged to go fair and softly. And in practice, you know we are the subjects. We have only the name of masters. And rather than give up this, which would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat, I hope General Washington and all our brave heroes would fight." Others wrote from Massachusetts to question why it was taking so long to accomplish what everyone at home was demanding. "People can't account for the hesitancy they observe," said James Warren, while his wife, Mercy Otis Warren, who was a playwright and a woman Adams particularly admired, lectured him on the ideal Republican government she foresaw for the future union of the colonies. Replying to James Warren on April 16th, Adams could hardly control his anger. "Have you seen the privateering resolves? Are not those independence enough for my beloved constituents? Have you seen the resolves opening our ports to all nations? Are these independence enough? What more would you have?" But writing to Warren again, Adams tried to explain the concern and hesitation over independence. "All great changes are irksome to the human mind, especially those which are attended with great dangers and uncertain effects. No man living can foresee the consequences of such a measure." The future was exceedingly dangerous, Adams felt certain. His mind was much on eventualities, given what he knew of human nature. "We may please ourselves with the prospect of free and popular governments, but there is great danger that those governments will not make us happy. God grant they may. But I fear that in every assembly, members will obtain an influence by noise, not sense, by meanness, not greatness, by ignorance, not learning, by contracted hearts, not large souls. There is one thing, my dear sir, that must be attempted and most sacredly observed, or we are all undone. There must be decency and respect and veneration introduced for persons of authority of every rank, or we are undone. In a popular government, this is our only way. To Mercy Warren, Adams counseled, "Patience, patience, patience." A week or so after denouncing the tyranny of men, Abigail wrote to say that in her loneliness and with so much riding on her shoulders, she scarcely knew which way to turn. "I miss my partner and find myself unequal to the cares which fall upon me. I want to say many things I must omit. It is not fit to wake the soul by tender strokes of art or to ruminate upon happiness we might enjoy, lest absences become intolerable." She wished he would burn her letters, she said in postscript. Sometimes he wrote to her from Congress itself. "When a man is seated in the midst of 40 people, some of whom are talking and others whispering, it is not easy to think what is proper to write," he would tell her. On April 18th, she asked if he would be home in May or June, and to say she thought of him only with the tenderest affection. He, on April 23rd, went on about his Philadelphia barber, who more than anyone helped him maintain a sense of proportion. "He is a little dapper fellow, a tongue as